Hi, and welcome to the Conservation in HD podcast series. I'm Natalie Sexton. I'm chief of the Human Dimensions branch of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. This podcast is part of our effort to put tools and resources into the hands of natural resource practitioners and is a collaboration with the National Conservation Training Center. Today, we're talking about connecting people with nature in the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. We're actually going to do some time traveling to the past, present, and future. Connecting to nature time machine, if you will. We'll examine some past, present, and future efforts of the Fish and Wildlife Service to connect people with nature and look at what role we have had in this effort and where we headed. And I'm lucky enough today to have Kristen Gilbert and Tyler Green here in the studio with me. Hello, ladies.
Hello. Hey.
We just finished a broadcast in the studio today on the Nature of American study. natureofamericans.org. Encourage you to check that out. And being at NCTC is such a great opportunity to reflect back on our conservation heroes and the history of the Fish and Wildlife Service, where we've been and where we're headed. So we decided to look at this idea of connecting people with nature and look at that through the lens of some of the key points in time and some of our conservation heroes. So Kristen, you're the Chief of Communications and Digital Services Branch for the Refuge System and leading the implementation of the Refuge System branding, content, and digital strategy. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And Tyler Green, you're the Public Affairs Specialist for the Services Northeast Region. Not only are you leading communications and outreach for the urban program back there, you're also working on your graduate program.
Yes, right? Yes, I am.
Okay.
Wish me luck.
Well, thanks a lot for you both coming. So are we ready to do some time traveling?
Right. Yeah. Can we give a little disclaimer up ahead that we're not historians?
Yes, we should do that.
Most of our, and we haven't really done a lot of research on the public figures that we're going to be talking about. It's kind of just what we've absorbed as working for Fish and Wildlife Service.
Yeah.
So we might have to do some on-the-fly research.
All right. Well, I'm going to, on this journey too, I started my career in the early 90s with the Fish and Wildlife Service as a researcher and come full circle 25 years later. So I'm hoping this makes me feel renewed and younger, this time traveling we're going to do. All right. So let's rewind. Pelican Island, Florida. Here we are. Year's 1903, when the first unit of what would become the National Wildlife Refuge System was established. It acquired its fame at the turn of the century as wildlife photographers and naturalists were visiting the area. And many of them were really disturbed by the slaughter of these pelicans, herons, egrets that were going on for the plumes for women's fashion. Even back in 1903, it was a social issue that was driving what we were doing, what we were thinking about in conservation. We have Paul Kregel, who cared about the pelicans and was really a staunch protector and really enlisted the support of many ornithologists, the Audubon Society. And then President at the time, Theodore Roosevelt, signed an executive order, actually he did it by proclamation, and set aside this small 3-acre wildlife sanctuary. So Kristen, tell us a little bit more about the scene back then.
It's interesting. I think about Paul Kregel and just kind of what was going on at the time and the stories you hear. And it was this one solo guy in his canoe kind of circumnavigating the island, just on the front line, protecting those birds from being harvested. And that, maybe, you know, that's kind of the vision I get. But it was really like this, we need to keep people out. We need to put them behind. You know, we need to have us between us and them is connection with wildlife. And he really was thinking, giving a longer view of it, because I mean, at the time there was all this market hunting going on. You were seeing these species declining because of our over harvesting. And I think he really was looking into the future and thinking, okay, like we have to kind of sever this connection that we have where we're using wildlife as this resource. So it was kind of that pivotal point with the Fish and Wildlife Service that kind of set the precedent for how we think about our connection with the people's connection with wildlife.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, and it strikes me too that with the establishment of what, you know, would become that first refuge and the time frame, you know, we're in that kind of Pinchot era where those scientists and those in the various agencies were the ones that were deferred to make the decision. So there really wasn't that large level kind of public engagement. You know, there's definitely some public outcries, but they were mostly coming from those really focused groups and organizations and just a few, you know, key individuals.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's see. Where should we go to next? Maybe let's... Let me tell you, I stayed in the Ding Darling. I'm staying in the Ding Darling. And last night, because I couldn't get to sleep, I looked at all of his cartoons. And I had seen some of them, but that was really, really fascinating. And, you know, I know he was really instrumental in the establishment of the Migratory Bird Hunting and Conservation Stamp Act, Duck Stamp Act. What can you tell us about that, Tyler? And where were we in history then? Lessons learned from that?
Back in 1934, when Ding Darling, was appointed to head the agency and launched a federal duck stamp program. That really resulted from market shooting and bounty hunting to supply food, unregulated sport hunting, and it led to a loss of wetland habitats. So the duck stamp, you know, took action to stop that destruction of land and habitat, and then to purchase habitat, kind of turn it back to the people so that we could have, you know, sustainable conservation. We were kind of talking about that earlier. And we joked about this, but the sale of the duck stamp, that was, you know, crowdsourcing for the Fish and Wildlife Service.
Like Kickstarter.
Oh my gosh. It was the first GoFundMe. And, you know, not only that, even now we have the Federal Duck Stamp Art Contest, and it's taking a tool. You know, we have this tool that helps us to conserve habitat, you know, provides a little bit of income for us to do that. But another way that we engage people in that is through art. You know, like you talked about Ding Darling's cartoons and the Federal Duck Stamp Art Contest. We engage, you know, hundreds of artists from across the country.
And youth.
Yeah. We have the Junior Duck Stamp Art Contest. So that really shows you that it's kind of, you recognize what the problem is, and then you take a step back and really figure out how can we address this. So with the duck stamp, they gave us purchasing authority, purchasing power, empowering the people to put money back in, you know, to purchase land and continue conservation.
And I think it really set the precedent for our base, like with, particularly with sportsmen. I mean, they became very invested in conservation that way, because they were essentially buying a part of it. I think what's also interesting about Ding Darling, like he used a different way to connect with the public and through the political cartoons. Like it wasn't necessarily, it was edgy, like pushing boundaries and kind of getting people to think about things from a different point of view. You know, we've tried through science for a long time, but he really was the first one to like meet people where they are in terms of like, this is this, let's get some political cartoons and papers and.
Yeah, what was really fascinating to me when I was looking at those two was that, you know, we always sometimes say, well, maybe that's outside of our mission or outside of our role. But his cartoons, while they were all grounded in natural resource conservation, you know, soil erosion, they also focused on, you know, that the population growth at the time and how that was going to be denuding the resources. I mean, really much bigger in scope than you think about what our, you know, more narrow mission was at the time. And I thought that was really fascinating. He was really addressing some of these really large-scale social issues and how natural resources kind of played into those. And I thought, you know, that was pretty insightful, for sure.
Still taking the long view.
Well, and then we fast forward to the 1960s. Let's go there for a minute. You know, this is really an interesting place in history for in the 1970 that the term human dimensions of natural resources was first coined. And that grew out of the recreation research. And really, a lot of that started after World War II. There were we had a lot more free time on our hands. You know, post-industrialization, there were new public demands on some of our public lands. And then Congress passed the Refuge Recreation Act, which authorized the recreation uses of refuges when those uses didn't interfere with those primary purposes, and it provided funding for recreation management for the first time. So that seems to me to be a kind of a pivotal point where we're saying, yeah, you know, like you said, Kristen, it's not just about, you know, us being a buffer between society and the resources, but we're really going to facilitate, you know, kind of responsible recreation of these areas and the enjoyment for, you know, for the public.
Fast forward 30 years or so, it's 1997. Refuge Improvement Act, which kind of, you know, we laid the groundwork for recreation being a part of what we do. And then we really expanded that with the Refuge Improvement Act, and particularly what we coin famously and culturally that nobody understands is the Big Six, our six wildlife-dependent uses on refuges, and they're priority now, which is exciting. You know, before it was, you know, they don't necessarily, we will provide those recreation opportunities where it was just kind of a suggestion before, and it really has shaped and changed what we do. But, you know, it's still been relatively exclusive, I guess, you know.
Yeah, definitely having the six priority uses, it helps. It kind of helps you for guidance and planning purposes. But at the same time, it distances you from a broader audience, folks who might not engage in just those six activities, but want to do other things that they enjoy outside with people that they care about. Okay, so if it's not part of the Big Six, does that mean that we don't cater and engage it? And some of our culture has kind of, you know, tipped to that a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. My favorite is, we'll allow jogging if you're watching birds at the same time.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that we've talked a lot about with one of the other teams that came out of our visioning process is that, you know, while I think the Improvement Act really did put recreation as a higher priority for that connection with wildlife, it was very activity based, which I think, you know, again, all of these things that have happened over time were, you know, based on our best available understanding at the time. But, you know, really today we're thinking a lot more about managing to an experience or to an outcome rather than managing for a certain activity. So mm-hmm. you're trying to achieve an experience with nature or have an experience with nature and the outdoors and wildlife through an activity. And so I think that's where that has, you know, maybe hit some stumbling blocks is that, you know, you're trying to think about, well, what activities are appropriate? Well, it depends on what types of experiences you're trying to provide.
Yeah.
You know, the other thing I think about with the Improvement Act, and I don't have it anymore, but I used to have my little Wildlife First button.
Oh, that's roots back to what we're talking about with Paul Craigle. And mm-hmm. I felt like I didn't have that experience in the 90s, but it was like this unspoken thing. I don't know if it came out of Fulfilling the Promise or some other exercise, but it's like Wildlife First, and it's kind of been ingrained mm-hmm. in our culture, mm-hmm. and that really doesn't leave a lot of room for people.
Right.
Yeah, people are second, maybe an afterthought, and that's kind of where we're at, I think, as we're moving forward. And we really addressed in the service's strategic vision for the refuge system, the Conserving the Future document, is we're really thinking about, okay, like, how is that wildlife first kind of mentality affecting us? And as we're taking the long view again, how do we kind of change what we're doing and
And I really thought a lot about this because I've been involved in a lot of refuge system planning and do very much understand that the sentiment of wildlife first and compatibility and appropriate use. And I think that it's important that we don't forget those and that, right. you know, what our primary, well, I shouldn't say our primary, but our mission is protecting wildlife and habitats, but for future generations, for people. And so, you know, it is a tough line to walk sometimes, mm-hmm. I think. And we are thinking about a lot differently. You know, one of my favorite quotes that I use is from Jim Kurth, one of our refuge chiefs. And he said that we used to feel that the way to keep wildlife first on refuges was keeping people out, and we've learned that when people can use and enjoy wildlife places and wildlife, they're going to become stronger supporters of the conservation movement. And I think that really captures it, that, you know, while, you know, it can be challenging at times to put that in practice, that's, you know, that's ultimately where we are and you know, where we're heading. So, Kristen, you mentioned the visioning process that we went through starting in 2011, and really, you know, that was the kind of the impetus for the development of the Human Dimensions branch, as well as many, 20 some recommendations that have been worked on ever since then, and really, you know, this overarching message, one of the overarching messages of all that. Those efforts is this ideal of relevancy, and it's certainly not unique to the Fish and Wildlife Service. The North American Waterfowl Management Plan in 2012 stood up this third leg of the stool, they called it, you know, wetlands, waterfowl, and people. You know, the state wildlife agencies are talking and thinking a lot about this issue of how, you know, the work that we're doing to protect wildlife and connect people with nature for future generations, how can we ensure that we're relevant and understand the values of our society. So can you guys talk about, you know, some of the efforts that you're involved with, where we're really trying to, put these new concepts into practice, not new concepts, but put this kind of shift in our thinking and continuing to be adaptive as those in the past have been and where we are and where you see us headed?
Yeah. I mean, I'll say there were several things that, you know, the vision and coming together back in 2011 that we sought to do. But one of the main things, probably one of the stronger recommendations that really grew into something, was the Urban Conservation Program and the creation of that. That's really kind of been the base of a lot of the things that, you know, we touched on during the broadcast, and that we'll probably talk about getting into here. But it's really knowing about changing demographics of the country. How do you connect with those folks? You know, if we're going to continue to remain relevant, we also have to appeal to people that we may not have engaged before, but who already enjoy these activities that we promote, like who already enjoy some of the big six, like wildlife photography and hunting and fishing is huge, you know, in communities across the country. So I think the urban program is definitely one. We've got these great standards of excellence. I think two of them really shouldn't be anything new that we're practicing, like knowing and relating to our community, providing a seat at the table. That's something we do just simply during the NEPA process. You know, anytime we want to take an action or a step, we've got to make sure that we bring people to the table, that we get input. And doing that, you know, you build credibility, you build authenticity in communities, whether you're working with an urban community or whether you're working with a rural community or pretty much anyone, you know, even just stakeholders and groups. So that's really important. And I think that program has really grown, you know, from our, because we went back to basics and it's a foundation for a lot of what we're trying to pioneer and move forward with in the conservation movement. So,
yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, and just to build on that, I think that, you know, our past has kind of led us through. We, you know, we used regulation and kind of keep people out mentality. But now, as we're kind of looking to the future again, it's like, you hear this in meetings, everybody's like, oh, communications is so important. Outreach is so important. People are so important. And I think we're at this cusp of, you know, combining what we've learned about how we've done things in the past, you know, what the future looks like in terms of how we should do things. And we're really starting to integrate that. So community engagement, outreach, communications, visitor services are all becoming more like use as a management tool, not necessarily as just an afterthought. We realize that if we don't implement some of these things, it's going to be to our detriment. Mm-hmm. And we've really been applying some of these lessons and trying to shift how we think about this idea of brand and branding. You know, what is the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service brand? And after doing, you know, learning a lot over the past couple of years, it's, you know, a lot of us think of it as the logo. But in reality, it's kind of the sum experiences that the public has with our organization and the feelings they have, the tone of voice in which we talk to them, and just the overall, you know, feeling they get from us. And so we're really trying to think at our brand. And I feel like, you know, I mentioned that we were kind of that wildlife first, not necessarily welcoming. And you can even see this, like there's, you know, how we fence refuges out, you know, and people see fences, people see keep out signs. And I think those are all expressions of our brand. And even though people, like, it's not a logo, people see that, and that's the experience they have with our brand. And so we're really trying to think about ways from a communications perspective and the stories we tell to the public, how do we kind of change that they can see themselves as part of this picture. And it really gets to this idea of, and it comes out a lot in the Nature of American study, I think, that it's reinforcing our thinking on this. But, you know, we need to give them, like, why is wildlife and wildlife conservation a benefit directly to you? Mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm. and you know, it could be the recreation and enjoyment benefits. We're seeing that, you know, people are overworked and overwhelmed and over digitized. Yeah. and we can offer this pretty amazing escape, you know, or interactions with wildlife. It doesn't even have to be going to a wildlife refuge. It can be.
And nearby, right?
Yeah. It can mm-hmm. be, you know, it can be, butterflies, you know, in their backyard. Mm-hmm. Like, if they associate those peaceful and exciting and surprising interactions that people have with wildlife, with the fish and wildlife. That's a cool benefit we're providing. So I think it's more thinking about the benefit that we provide, to, you know, like thinking of the last part of our mission, actually. You know, mm-hmm. we're no longer thinking about how we do things or what we're doing. You know, we know we use partners, we know we do science, we know we do all these conservation things. It's like putting the front part of for the benefit of the American people at the front of our brand. Like, that is really what we're trying to do. It's not changing anything, it's taking the long view and seeing what's gonna help us be relevant to the future. Mm-hmm.
So for the skeptic listening, how does putting that to the front of our brand help us do the what some may consider the core of our mission, protecting and conserving fish, wildlife, and their habitats?
I mean, we can't do that alone. We don't do anything alone. If we don't have support, if we don't have advocacy for the work that we do, it honestly doesn't matter what we do now. If in 20 years, if in 50 years, and if in 100 years, we don't have a legacy, if we don't have sustainability in our work, then it doesn't matter. Yeah. So you need that public support. I mean, that shapes, like, public opinion and support really shapes, you know, our country. Right.
So, well, and I think, you know, one of the things that I've talked with, you know, some wildlife biologists and others that I have the utmost respect for, and, you know, they've told me, too, that, you know, yes, we want the advocacy and we want to ensure funding for our agency, but if you go further than that, it's really we want to ensure that we continue this conservation ethic in our country. And that requires that people value those resources, and we're really that conduit, you know, we're that bridge builder, so to speak, to help ensure that happens, especially how important nature is to, you know, to our very being. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's a lot of what we have just touched on in this broadcast, is just this idea of that we have this inherent need for nature.
Yeah.
And how cool is it that we can be, you know, one of the go-to places and go-to organizations to provide that. Yeah. To provide that to society.
And nature, you know, nature is not a place you have to travel to. Like, if you go outside, if you walk to the store, I mean, it can be a destination, but it's not necessarily one. And so when people are able to go outside, when there's greenery, when there's fresh air, we contribute to that, you know, as a conservation agency. It's a network of several, you know, organizations and agencies. But if it weren't for some of this work that we're doing, that wouldn't be the case for people. And so regardless of whether or not, you know, some people are able to make it out to some of our public lands, I think, you know, that's the ideal. We want that. But even if not, there's, you know, we still want folks to recognize the importance, the role that we can play, you know, having a refuge, like having some of these buffers. I mean, that's huge. Like, if you think about, you know, refuges provide clean air. I feel like I sound like an advertisement, but it's true. I mean, they're natural, clean water. But I mean, it's like they're natural storm buffers. I mean, there's several benefits. So we have to make that connection for people.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think the biologists in our organization would also agree with us in a lot of ways, is that, you know, if you think about all the threats to wildlife, they're from humans. They're no longer the plume hunters that are going out to market harvests, but it's in the decisions that we're, you know, the decisions that we make every day. I think about, like, it's how we drive on roads. I think about, like, ocelot recovery that we just saw a presentation on in Texas. Like, it's, you know, creating roads that can control, manage people, not necessarily manage the wildlife, and getting people to change their behavior. And that's just an integral part of the solution, but people aren't going to be motivated to change their behavior unless, you know, they can care and connect with us in a different way.
And then, like, if wildlife, you know, aren't doing well in a certain area, like, what does that really mean about, like, you know, like, the nature of it, the people of it too? Like, if the wildlife aren't thriving and doing well, that's pretty reflective of, you know, it could be a bigger problem. So
Well, I want to touch on a few resources that could give folks listening some more info on some of the things that you guys have hit on. The outcomes and some of the products of that refuge system visioning process, which a lot of that work since then has really applied to, you know, other programs in the service as well. And that's at fws.gov/refuges/vision.
Or just Google conserving the future.
Oh, okay. And then we've got our urban program.
Yeah.
Which, can they just Google
They can. I think our URL is a little bit more current.
It's fws.gov/urban.
Yeah, okay. We were laughing about all the Google. You don't even really need a URL anymore. And then we have natureofamericans.org, which is this national study that's just come out. Well, ladies, anything in closing? This has been a really fun trip. I feel really refreshed. I feel younger. We went back in time and projected out to the future a little bit. I really want to thank you both for being here. Any closing thoughts that you have today?
I mean, I'll say part of one of the projects I've been working on over the last year is in our national communications framework. And several goals are outlined. One of the main ones is to grow a connected constituency. And I really just want to close out with this because I mentioned it to you yesterday, but it's really, if you think about it, the Fish and Wildlife Service is kind of like, it's our little baby. It's where we work. We want people to love it. And the more supporters and the more advocates you have, the more people that love this work that you do, it's like the easier it is for you to thrive and grow and do your job. It's kind of like, you know, if you have a family member or a kid, like the more help and support that you have to do that, you know, it's like you're setting it up for success. And that's really what it's about. It's like growing our base, making sure that the folks we already connect with know that, you know, we're doing more to have more resources, more access. And so I just go back to that. It's making sure we have a connected constituency, that we grow it, you know, but we still remain true to who we are and to, you know, who's really been supporting us and helping us through this process in the first place.
Yeah, I think that captures it.
Great. Well, I'd encourage you guys to check out the broadcast that we did on the Nature of Americans, Disconnections and Recommendations for Reconnections, which featured you both. I think that was really, really great and insightful. And look, search in Google for NCTC Human Dimensions video, and you'll find it there. And we've got a lot of other podcasts in the works, and we've got several more on tap coming up soon. So if you guys that are listening have any ideas for future podcasts, you can email us at the Human Dimensions branch at human_dimensions@fws.gov. And then if you're interested in looking for some of the podcasts that have already been published, just search Human Dimensions and Conservation in the podcast's iTunes store. And they're also on the NCTC podcast page, which you can find by Googling NCTC podcasts. So thank you all for listening. Thank you both for being here today. It was really a lot of fun and great discussion. And we'll be with you next time.